All right, welcome back, everybody. It is Wednesday, 11:15, September 8th. We're back on track with lecture. Everybody's logging in. This is perfect. You guys are all coming back. Recording is up and running, and I want to pick up kind of where we left off. So I was looking at and reviewing where we left off. Let me go ahead and do a screen share and kind of show where we were at. So this is what we were looking at previously. We were looking at hydride shifts and alkyl shifts in terms of the alkenes, and talking about the stability of those different alkenes that can form, and looking at different factors that can contribute to making a carbocation more stable. So in some cases, we were looking at induction, where we're looking at primary, secondary, tertiary, where tertiary were most stable. In this case, we had an oxygen, and that the oxygen and the resonance associated with the carbocation can make the carbocation more stable. And we talked about some differences in terms of factors to look at: electronegativity, hybridization, resonance, size, induction, and just reviewing many of these topics that would come from Chem 12A. So let me pick up with a new lecture here, today being September 8th. And what we reviewed, what we looked at was doing both hydration and halogenation. And what we found with the hydration and the halogenation, hydration being the addition of water. So if we looked at an alkene, and we looked at adding water across that with some acid, H2SO4, that we found that we wound up getting the water in that location. If we did halogenation and we did HX, we found that we got the X in that location. The acid that's coming from each of these, if we think about the acid and coming from each of these, the proton that's here, let's make that a little bit smaller. The proton here and the proton here, those guys are ending up in these positions adjacent to where the nucleophile is coming in and adding. And so that was hydration. This one was halogenation. And we put a note with these, and we say that these go through a carbocation. And because they go through the carbocation, we need to watch for hydride and alkyl shifts. And the same is true here. Watch for shifts. So that if we had something, an example, if we had something that had the alkene out on this end and we did HX, that the mechanism is going to go through a process where it grabs the proton, we create the more stable secondary carbocation, that hydrogen adds out on that terminal end, and then there's the possibility that we get the 1,2 hydride shift. Not only the possibility, but this is the most likely product, is this hydride shift. And we've moved the hydrogen over there, and then the halogen X comes in and binds to it and gives the product. And there's no way to prevent this, no way in this reaction, but we will see that there is other ways to prevent this. So the H that is coming in and adding, we're tracking kind of where that's going and how it's moving. And this is our 1,2 hydride shift. So all of that is review. The question is here, how do we prevent the shift? In other words, what we want to ask is, how do we do this? How do we take that guy and add HX such that we can get this? Because what if we want this?
In the presence of peroxides?
Not peroxides. Not for this one. This one we have to do a little bit different. We have to find a way to prevent the shift. And preventing the shift is accomplished. So I've been writing kind of fast. I don't know if you guys are keeping up with what I'm doing. But the question is, how do we prevent that shift? And the reaction that allows us to prevent the shift is called oxymercuration demercuration. And that's what we want to go into. That's what we want to look at. So let's pull in oxymercuration demercuration. And again, it's this process of presenting, here's what Mother Nature does. Now, how do we circumvent Mother Nature? Or how do we use Mother Nature to accomplish what we want to do? That's where an organic chemist comes at this. And so we look at it and say, these aren't all separate reactions. We say that these are all related reactions and ways of achieving a particular goal. So Mother Nature says, oh, sorry, you can't get that. And we're like, no, I'm pretty sure we can get that. We just need to find the right thing to do it with. We need to find a way to control the mechanism. So here's how we control the mechanism. So we do a reaction that's called oxymercuration demercuration. And in this reaction, what we do is we use a material that is called mercury acetate. And it's mercury 2 acetate. And it's HgOAC2. So what is OAC? OAC is an abbreviation that we use for acetate. And it is mercury that is bound to the oxygen of the conjugate base of acetic acid, acetate. And it has a negative charge on the oxygen and resonance between the two oxygens. And that mercury is bound on both sides. And this is a 2+ mercury, and it's bound to the two acetates. And so OAC equals acetate. And it would normally have the negative charge on it. It's the conjugate base of acetic acid. So that's what OAC is. And the way in which this reaction works is we take the alkene and we react it with mercury acetate, HgOAC2. And then we add in whatever nucleophile we want. Usually if we were doing a halogen and we were trying to put in like a bromide or something, we would add in sodium bromide. This would be the first step. And in this first step, what winds up happening is it's the mercury that reacts as the electrophile. So here, the mercury is a 2+, is the electrophile. And these OAC molecules that are here that are bound to it, actually, I'll just do it as a covalent bond, which works out just fine. I'll leave this one over here. This guy reaches out and grabs the mercury. The lone pair of electrons, or the pair, it's not really a lone pair, but the pi bond reaches out, grabs the mercury. The mercury lets go of one of the acetates. And it's really a concerted mechanism, but I'll draw it as if it's stepwise just to give us a better sort of idea and understanding of what's going on. It grabs onto the mercury. The mercury is holding on to one of the acetates, but the mercury also has a series of lone pairs that are on the mercury. And that mercury turns around and binds to the carbocation, preventing any sort of shift. That mercury, in binding to that carbocation now, has a positive charge that is split between the two centers. And if I think about what's going on here, I'm going to do a partial eraser. This bond is a weakened bond. This side is weak. And it's weak because that's where the carbocation can be stabilized the most effectively, is at the secondary position. So what winds up happening is, as the nucleophile comes in on this, the bromide attacks that position, opening up the mercury. Now, this guy is called a cyclic mercurium ion. And it's the cyclic mercurium ion that prevents any sort of hydride or alkyl shift. So once the shifts are prevented, now what happens is the bromide is attached and the mercury is attached. And now we've got to get rid of the mercury. So getting rid of the mercury is a second step. This is the demercuration. Oxymercuration, demercuration. So in the second step, what we do is we take the mercury and we react it with sodium borohydride. Now, what sodium borohydride does is it allows for the transfer of a hydride. And the hydride, having a partial minus on it, knocks out the mercury. And it's as if it was never there. And it produces a product that looks like we got the exact Markovnikov substitution that we wanted without any sort of shifts. So that's the job of the hydride. Is the job of the hydride is to remove the mercury and eliminate the mercury from this reaction. And what we typically do is we typically write it in all one sequence. We don't generally write it in two separate steps. So the reaction overall, in writing the reaction, would look like this. We would take the product or the reactant that we want. We react it one with mercury acetate, two, the halogen that we want. And then in a second step, we use sodium borohydride and we would write that product as the standard Markovnikov product without shifts. So it's a way of being able to get the product without a shift.
So you do actually write a text, or is that just for explanation?
I'm sorry, in what I'm writing underneath it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just writing that for explanation for your notes.
So that's not going on the, if you actually do a thing, that's not actually going into paper.
Right.
That's obvious to the observer by looking at the two pictures.
Yes.
Got it.
Yes. And so now what I would say is, from this material, we could look at this material and say, all right, I have now a method by which I can go in and I can create this product. I have a method by which I can go in and I can create this product. And not only can I get a bromide there, but I could also get a hydroxide there. So I could say, I've got a method by which I could go in and create this alcohol. or I've got a method by which I could go in and create this alcohol. So this would be with HBR, or if I'm looking at that, or this would be water and sulfuric acid in the way that I'm adding it. This would be with the mercury acetate. And I'm using either sodium bromide or I'm using water in there as my nucleophile. And then a second step, I'm doing the sodium boron hydride. The question is, what if I want this? How do I get that? Or how do I get that guy? So from this one product, I'm being able to control, and I'm being able to place the bromide or the hydroxyl group on the tertiary position. I'm able to place it on the secondary position off the alkene. Can I place it on the primary position, right? So these are all the different positions that I can place this. How do I have control? How can I actually do this piece? And this gives me yet a third reaction to be able to discuss and talk about and look at what we can actually do here. So the question is, how do I go through and do this? And this requires a completely different type of reaction. So in order to do this step, to get this type of reactivity, we need to understand a little bit more about boron. So let's start by looking at diborane and boron. Borane is a gas, and it, let's do it this way. This is borane. If you take two boranes and combine them, you can make diborane. And this is diborane. So this is a gas, and this is how it exists as a gas in nature, as diborane. Boron is an immensely interesting element. The fifth element in the periodic table, it's closely related to carbon. It's a little bit smaller than carbon. But because boron only has three valence electrons, unlike carbon that has four valence electrons, because of the three valence electrons, boron usually only makes three bonds. And in making those three bonds, it has an empty p orbital. That empty p orbital gives it all sorts of special properties. It's isoelectronic. With a carbocation. Which means it's carbocation-like, but it gives it some interesting properties. Now, diborane is fascinating because what diborane is that when you look at the polarity between carbon and hydrogen, the polarity is such that carbon gets the partial minus and hydrogen gets the partial positive. So hydrogen is 2.5. And I believe hydrogen is like 2.35 in its electronegativity. Boron and hydrogen, 2.35, but boron is 2.0. And so the electronegativity switches, and the hydrogen is more electronegative than is the boron. And so all of a sudden, what we see here is that the boron gets the partial positive and the hydrogen gets the partial minus. It has a completely different electronegativity than the carbon-hydrogen bond. And as such, the hydrogen carries the electron density. And so what this is that this is a boron-hydrogen bond where the hydrogen is carrying the electron density, and it is reverse bonding back to the boron. And so this type of bond is like a hydrogen bond in reverse. Normally, when we say a hydrogen bond, normally we're saying something that an oxygen that has a hydrogen on it, where this is a great big partial positive. And then we have something with lone pairs that donates electron density back to that. And that's what we call a normal hydrogen bond. But with a boron, the hydrogen is partial minus. And this thing is an empty p orbital. And the electron density is donated that way. It's the reverse of a normal hydrogen bond. So it does some really, really cool things. One of the ways that we make use of boron is to take the diborane and to treat it with THF, tetrahydrofuran. It's an ether solvent. The ether solvent breaks up the diborane and solubilizes it into solution. THF is a cyclic ether in a five-membered ring system. And what this does is it binds to the boron. Making the boron tetrahedral. And this is called borane THF. And this is a liquid and now can be used as a solvent. And it allows us to be able to do what are called hydroborations. So now what we're going to look at is the hydroboration mechanism of how hydroboration works. Hydroboration was discovered by H.C. Brown. H.C. Brown won the Nobel Prize for this chemical reaction. And what it does is it allows you to take an alkene and to react it with BH3THF. So the dot implies that they're associated together. And that's what the borane THF is here, BH3THF. That's how we write it. What the boron does is the boron binds to the double bond as the free borane. And in binding to it, it lines up partial minus and partial positive, and the electrons travel this direction and this direction. And as it binds to it and it goes through this transition state, the transition state that it goes through, this is a concerted binding, but asymmetric. So this transition state, what it looks like is that I've got a dotted line here, a dotted line there, and I'm already biffing it, and I need to swap it and change it before I go too much further. Let's look at the two transition states. And that will make this make more sense. Two options. How to take a mistake and turn it into something not a mistake. The transition state has a buildup of negative charge and a buildup of positive charge in that it's an asymmetric transition state. And we can envision that transition state occurring in two different ways. In the same way that we can create a carbocation and we could look at the carbocation on both sides of the double bond, we could look at this transition state occurring on both sides of the double bond. And so here what I'll do is I'll put the boron out here and I'll put the hydrogen out here. And we'll look at it this way with a partial minus and a partial positive. these are the two possible ways in which this goes. The boron adds slightly ahead of the hydride. That slightly ahead of the hydride is what provides the selectivity. This gives selectivity. Because what happens is we're looking at now a carbocation formation or partial positive charge buildup on a primary center versus the more stable partial positive charge buildup on the secondary center. So which one of those would be more stable? The positive charge building up on the secondary center or the positive charge building up on the primary center? What do you think would be more stable? It's the same as a carbocation. Do I want to see a carbocation on the primary or do I want to see a carbocation on the secondary?
Secondary.
Secondary, absolutely. This one is more stable. And if this is more stable, this is lower E sub A, lower activation energy for its formation. And so all of the reactivity goes through that more stable, lower energy pathway. And so what happens is the boron adds, and the boron adds here, and the hydride adds here. And this becomes major.
So Jason, for resonance structures and for carbocations and radicals, are they always gonna be more stable when you go to more substituted positions? So like tertiary will always be more stable to have it there in that position. And then for induction, is it always the opposite? So you'll have more stability on the primary?
No. It is that when we look at induction, induction is always going to make it more stable on the more substituted center.
Okay.
So that we're always looking at tertiary being more stable than secondary, being more stable than primary. Now, you said some other things. You said resonance, and you said free radicals, and you said a whole bunch of other things. Carbocations and free radicals have the same stability factors.
Right.
So that those factors that stabilize a carbocation are the exact same factors that stabilize a free radical, mostly to a great approximation. There are some slight differences that we need to look at. But what we see here is that in this case, because the boron is adding symmetrically, or I should say concerted, because the boron is adding concerted, there is no actual carbocation and there is no resonance. So resonance doesn't really play a role in this, not in this guy. This is really, really about inductive factors and induction with the secondary versus tertiary versus secondary versus primary.
Okay.
All right. So we always go for the more stable tertiary or secondary over primary center.
Okay.
And because it's concerted, there's also no shifts. So no shifts. No resonance. And tertiary greater than secondary, greater than primary in terms of formation for the partial positive, but that is where the hydride is going. So that is a key step because we're looking at here, this is my hydride, and we're looking at where the hydride is being placed because the hydride is being placed on the tertiary, secondary over primary, not the boron. This is where the hydride gets placed. So the way this reaction works is that this guy, once formed with BH3THF, initially forms this, but then this goes on and reacts multiple times. And eventually what is created is what is called a trialkyl borane. So this is the trialkyl borane. See, all three of these hydrogens, all three hydrogens can be transferred. And then the trialkyl borane, what we do is an oxidation. So in a second step, this is an oxidation step. And it's accomplished using hydrogen peroxide, sodium hydroxide, and water. In this step, what winds up happening is the boron is still got an empty p orbital. And what happens here is that this combination of reagents produces the peroxide anion. The trialkyl borane that we've been creating has the empty p orbital. And this comes and binds into that empty p orbital. And it makes what's called an 8 complex. When boron takes on 4 bonds, it takes on a negative charge. And what's really cool about this 8 complex is that it doesn't want to be negatively charged. Boron is super small and it's super unstable with the negative charge like this. So it tries to alleviate the negative charge. And what it does to alleviate the negative charge is one of these bonds breaks and shifts and it takes its electrons with it. So this bond breaks and it binds to the oxygen, and this bond breaks and becomes a leaving group and takes its electrons with it. And so an OH actually becomes a leaving group, and this thing starts to tear apart. And what happens is we make an oxygen carbon bond. And we get OH minus. Now, what winds up happening is another peroxide comes in. And this happens all over again. And this goes multiple times until what happens is you get the trialkoxyborane. And then what happens is hydroxide ion comes in, binds to the boron. And then these alcohols liberate off the boron and it exchanges the hydroxyl group. So hydroxyl group comes in and one of these comes off and it goes to become this guy. Actually, this is initially an O minus, but it'll get protonated in a little bit here. And that happens multiple times until the end fate of the boron is that the boron becomes boric acid, which is non-toxic. Boric acid is actually what they use as laundry detergent. It is the 20 Mule Team Laundry Detergent, Borax. That's boric acid. It's a completely non-toxic product. And we get three equivalents of this guy that winds up getting protonated as the alcohol. And so the overall reaction, as we look at that overall reaction, what we find is this. If we take the alkene and we react it with one BH3THF, number two, we do the oxidation with sodium hydroxide, hydrogen peroxide, and water. We end up with the alcohol and the byproduct is boric acid at the end. And it allows us to be able to put the hydroxyl group on the terminal end where we want to. And then we're going to find that there are some other reactions, such as, I don't know if you guys have seen these, PCl3, where I can take and turn that alcohol into a chloride. Or actually, let's do it this way. Let's change this, I'm sorry. Let's do PBr3, change it into a bromide. Or I could take that alcohol and react it with SOCl2, thionyl chloride, and I could turn it into a chloride. And that there are reactions that can take me from the hydroxyl group to halogens, and I can convert the hydroxyl group into halogens by several other reactions, several other means. So this means that now I have total control that I can take this material and I can make anything I want out of it. I can take it and I can turn it into a halogen that sits in that position, or I can turn it into a hydroxyl group that sits in that position. I could take it and I could turn it into a halogen that sits there, or an alcohol that sits there, or I could take it and turn it into a halogen in that position or the alcohol in that position, and I can control it at will. And so this would just be with HX or H2O and H2SO4. This one would be with the mercury acetate. Oops, and then I need frozen. To bring, what's that? Oh, it froze. Yeah, you're right. Thank you. So I could bring in the mercury acetate, and then I could bring in the nucleophile, whatever I want that nucleophile to be. And then two, I use the sodium borohydride. And then this last one would be first step BH3THF and second step oxidation. And then I might have a third step where I might need to do PCl3 or PBr3 or SOCl2 in order to convert it into a halogen if I wanted to do that. And that gives me complete control over all those different reactions by different mechanisms, which is like super exciting in terms of what we can do with it. All right, so let's stick on this boron idea for a minute. And Let's look at another reaction. Let you guys catch up for a second, see where we're at there. Because the boron is fascinating in what it's able to do. And the reason that it was able to do it is because there was a difference in the two centers, primary versus secondary. What happens if there isn't that difference between the two centers? So let's look at this. What happens if I take this guy and do BH3THF? And then 2 oxidation. So now when I look at these two centers, both of these centers are secondary. And because they're both secondary, there's no stability difference. And yet the observation when doing this chemical reaction is that I find the hydroxyl group landing on that carbon and the hydroxyl group landing on that carbon. And the percentages that I get are about 57% to 43%. I get 43% here and 57% here. So the question is, why? Why are the percentage difference? Why is one 43% and the other 57% when they're both secondary centers? If this reaction were governed by electronics, I should get 50-50 because they're both secondary. So why am I seeing this reaction have a preference for the hydroxyl group farther to the right? Anybody?
Oh, a steric interaction somehow.
Steric interactions, yeah. Because when the boron adds, and this is what H.C. Brown saw. H.C. Brown observed that when the boron adds, that the boron adding to this center has sterics associated with it versus the boron adding out to this center has less sterics. And so thus, this one became 43%. And this one 57%. So what H.C. Brown said was, how do I take that small percentage and how do I make that percentage 99%? How can I take something that's just this small difference and make it bigger? Well, the obvious answer is you make the sterics bigger, right? But the problem is, if you want to make the sterics bigger, I could put a tertiary butyl over here. I could put more sterics over here. But the point is not to change the sterics on the substrate, because if you change the sterics on the substrate, then that means that you can only use that substrate. That means that the substrate is the only thing that's different. So how can I change the sterics on the boron is what H.C. Brown decided. And he decided to make a new boron reagent that had more sterics. So what H.C. Brown did is he took a molecule that is this guy that has 2 double bonds in it. So this is cyclooctadiene. And it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So it's 1,5 cyclooctadiene, and he hydroborated this with BH3THF. And what it does is it hydroborates the first side. So the boron and the hydrogen hydroborate the first side, reaching out and grabbing the boron and adding back in. And then it hydroborates the other side with the same boron. So the boron binds here. And then it turns around and it does the same thing on the other side of the molecule. So one of the hydrogens binds here, and this thing turns around and binds to the boron. And it creates a bicyclic molecule. Essentially, it's doing this. Where I had the boron here and the hydrogen there, now in the double bond, it's able to do it again. And that leads to the boron binding into this thing. And the boron binds to this side and to this side over here. And it still has one hydrogen left over. And that molecule, when you take a look at what that molecule is, that molecule forms a structure that looks like this. And this is called 9-boro-bicyclo-nonane. And that is abbreviated 9-BBN. And instead of drawing it as I've drawn it, the way that we typically draw it is to cartoon it, as if the boron has a parachute on it. And that parachute, this guy, is the bicyclic ring system. And that's the 9-boro bicyclonanane. The 9 being the position of the boron. So 9-boro bicyclonanane. And it's actually 9-boro 331 nonane. So there's actually a 331 that's in there between the nonane. So in here, it's supposed to be 3.3.1 in the way that we name bicyclic ring systems. And that reagent now is a reagent that has a huge steric group on it that can give us great selectivity. So if we go back to this molecule now, and we take this and we use 9-BBN, and then we do the oxidation step, hydrogen peroxide, sodium hydroxide, and water. Now what we find is that we're able to put the hydroxyl group out here, and we're able to get 99%. So that's actually greater than 99%. It's like 99.8%. So that's the amazing thing with 9-BBN, is 9-BBN works sterically. And it is the concept, the idea that 9-BBN is so big that if the boron were to go here with that big parachute on it, that is just a tremendous amount of sterics. And that the boron going in this position is much more stable. Lower E sub A for its formation. And so that's where the hydroxyl group winds up. Okay. How are we doing? You guys following?
Reasonably, yeah.
Understanding the difference between these reagents. So this is what is called regioselective. Regioselectivity describes a reaction in which I look at the different positions that can happen, where 9-BBN adds to it, and then we do the oxidation, That's the symbol for oxidation, one way to do that. And I get a major product where this guy is major and this guy is minor. And this is regioselective. So that's what we call regioselectivity. The reaction is both regioselective and stereoselective. So what do we mean by stereoselective? So this one we understand, regioselective just means that there are two different positions here that I could look at a position with less sterics and more sterics, and that I'm seeing, you know, a major product that is coming out of this and a minor product that is coming out of this. That's the regioselectivity. You can think of regioselectivity as being sort of region where reaction takes place. So if that's the regioselectivity, then what is the stereoselectivity? Where does the stereoselectivity comes from? Stereoselectivity comes from the idea that this reaction is concerted. It's a concerted addition. The regioselectivity comes from the sterics and partial positive in the reaction. So let's look at this concerted reaction. Let's see what I mean by this. If we take a six-membered ring system and we take and we add to it either BH3THF or 9BBN. Let's do it with BH3THF. And then I go through two and do the oxidation. The way in which the reaction takes place is that the boron and the hydrogen, making sure that I'm doing the right thing here, come from the same face. Electrons are transferring this way and this way. And as they do that, and there was a hydrogen that was here already, as they do that, they come from the same face. It's what we call a syn addition from the same face. And the oxidation, when the oxidation occurs, it recurs with retention of configuration. So the oxidation goes with retention. That retention of configuration means that whatever side the boron was on, that's the same side that the hydroxyl group will come from. And so what we find is that when we do the addition looks like this. We get the hydrogen and the boron, or the hydroxyl group, coming from the same face. So these guys that were added in, if we're tracking the boron and looking at where the hydrogen goes and where the boron goes, that they come from the same face. And that's what we mean by syn addition. Now, we still get the plus minus. It can come from the top or it can come from the bottom, but the fact is that they're coming from the same face. And that's what gives it stereoselectivity. That's what makes it stereoselective, is the synaddition from the same face. And so the reaction is both regioselective and stereoselective. And that's a critical factor in these. All right, so that if I take and look at doing a 5-membered ring system, put a double bond in it, put a group there, and I look at doing 9 BBN, and then number two, I look at doing sodium hydroxide, hydrogen peroxide, and water. What's my product going to be? Take a minute and draw the product and see what you get. I'll tell you what, work on that one. And let's also do this with let's compare these two. See how they do. Give me a thumbs up when you guys are ready.
So we get an oxygen double bonded to a less directly hindered position with 9 BBN.
It won't be double bonded, but yeah, you get, so here what we're expecting is that that the boron is going to go into this position and that's going to become a hydroxyl group. And the hydrogen is going to go into the other position. And so we are expecting that, let's do it this way. We get the OH and the H, but this is not a stereocenter. So I won't get too caught up into what's going on there. And I will get, because I have created one stereocenter.
Is chiral center the same thing as stereocenter?
It is. Usually the terms that we use, chiral center, center of chirality, stereocenter, and stereogenic center. Out of all of these different terms, my preferred term is the stereogenic center. Okay. A chiral center, chiral really means handedness. And oftentimes there's more than one center of chirality. Oftentimes there is you know, multiple stereocenters that are in it. And so stereocenter is sort of like the better term. These two are not generally good terms. These are terms that don't adequately describe molecules that have multiple stereogenic centers. So a stereogenic center is a center that has four things attached to it that can produce different orientations that give rise to stereoisomers. And so stereogenic center is the preferred term. But sometimes we slang that and we call it a stereocenter. Sometimes we get into center of chirality or chiral center. You'll hear all these different terms, but the preferred term is the stereogenic center term. Okay, so what happens with the water in the H2SO4 then? How is this different?
Then we're going to have the OHB on the more, to be on the side of the alkene that's with more sterics.
Okay, so let me be clear real quick that the first one took place by the 9-BBN trying to get away from the big center that was over here, from the sterics over here. And so as this added, it added this way and that way. And that's what gave rise to the alcohol over there. Now, under this way, this one is secondary and this one is secondary. And the sterics really don't matter much to the water. So what winds up happening is this thing grabs a proton. But as it grabs a proton, it kind of goes different routes. And it can grab that proton over here, creating the carbocation in that position. It can grab that proton here, creating the carbocation in that position. And then this can undergo an alkyl shift, which creates the more stable carbocation. And now all three of these can give products. And so if we say that this is A, this is B, this is C, what I wind up seeing here is a slew of products where I get the hydroxyl group there. I get the hydroxyl group here. I get the hydroxyl group here. And what's major? This is probably major. But also note that this now has two different stereocenters. So this is going to be four isomers in that one. This has one stereocenter. This is going to have two isomers. And this has one stereocenter. This is going to have two isomers. So what comes out of this is 6, 7, 8. This is 8 products total. That thing is just a mess. This one has 2 products, 2 enantiomers, and is regioselective and stereoselective. And so that's what I kind of wanted to show you, that this one is not regio or stereo selective. And we just get a mess of products that comes out of it. This one is both regio and stereo selective.
Is there a term for a mess of product comes out of it?
Is there a term for a mess? It's called a mess. Mixture of isomers. It's just there's no common term for that. We do have terms. The terms that we use are regioselective. That is selective for location. We have stereo. Selective. Stereo selective is selective for sin versus anti. This is selective for enantiomers. And then, or I should say, it's selective for a diastereomer set. And then we have enantioselective. And we haven't done an enantioselective one yet. Enantioselective is selective for a single enantiomer. Very difficult to do, very special type of reaction that does enantioselective. So those are our three different types of selectivity: regio, stereo, and enantio. We might do enantioselective at some later time, and we'll look at some enantioselective reactions. Okay. What else do I need to show you here? Okay, let's go back to halogenations. We've already sort of previewed halogenation. I mean, we know in halogenation that if we take HBr, and oftentimes these are done in acetic acid, ACOH, where ACOH equals acetic acid. Remember, just a little bit ago, we did OAC, and this equals the conjugate base, so that's acetate. This is acetic acid. So we're seeing these abbreviations. We're trying to get familiar with these abbreviations as we see them. If we do halogenation, you guys know this reaction. You could do this reaction. You could tell me what the product is. Let me give 1, 2, 3, and 4. Tell me what carbon number the bromide is going to end up on. You could throw it into the chat, you could say it out loud, however you want to communicate it. Number two, yeah, Laura, perfect. So this is going to go through the carbocation where I first pick up the proton. This is indeed example of regioselective, where I get the more stable carbocation. The bromide comes in, binds to the carbocation, and I end up with my product. That was 1, 2, 3, and 4, and it did indeed end up on 2. Thank you, Laura. Let's do the same thing here. Let's take and do a 5-membered ring system with a methyl group in it, and let's do HCl and acetic acid. And let's label the carbons 1, 2. Let's do it this way. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. Okay, where is the chloride going to land now? Oh, by the way, this is about 90%. Where's the chloride going to land in the second one? Laura's got it again. Laura's saying carbon number 1. And indeed, same thing is happening here. Exact same process. We're grabbing the proton. We're going through the more stable carbocation. Proton adds to carbon number two, carbocation at carbon number one. Chloride comes in and attacks, and we get the product, five-membered ring system, chloride at position number one, hydrogen at position number two, and this is pretty much 100% in the terms, in the way that this goes. All right, you guys are doing great. Let's do this one. Let's do HBr, acetic acid. And we'll throw in the temperature here. What do we get now? Oh, let's do it this way. 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. Where's the bromide going?
Two.
The bromide is going two. Chloe, nice work. Anybody else want to contribute?
Three.
I agree with three. I agree with both two and three, and I'll show you why. We grab the proton. Proton gets grabbed. We go to the more stable carbocation. That more stable carbocation is on two. This one's four, this one's five. But then it's likely that we'll get the hydride shift because that takes us to the tertiary carbocation. And then after getting that tertiary carbocation, then the bromide can come in and can attack. And so actually what we see is that the bromide comes in and attacks at both positions. And we wind up creating both products where it is on two, and on three.
So the one on two only occurs because it's cold?
No, it occurs. I think that what I'm trying to talk here is more ratios, that I'm more interested in that this is about 40% and this one's about 60%. And so when we say major, major doesn't mean only. Major means more than the other one. And how much more is a good thing to look at so that we understand how much more. So three, the bromide going on three is major, but only by about 60%.
What's the temperature for here?
Well, temperature, I could throw temperature on each of these, that usually these are sort of classic temperatures that we would do these reactions. If we turn the temperature up and we put it up at like 25 degrees, you might get a little bit more of the major product. We might get more of the shift. There's more energy in the system to allow for the shift. But at 0 degrees C, which is sort of a classic temperature to do these reactions, this is about the ratio that we would see. All right. With these ratios, what if I want to not get those other things? What if I want to get this guy? Or let's leave it as a bromide. How do I get the bromide there? How can I make this major?
Could you use hydrogen peroxide?
Hydrogen peroxide is a great way. So there's actually two ways to do this. So let's do it first this way. What if I took this and reacted it with BH3THF and then I did the oxidation? what I would end up with is the primary alcohol. And then from that primary alcohol, I could use PBr3 in order to convert this into the bromide. And I could achieve the bromide, swapping out that hydroxyl group for a bromide. This reaction, by the way, works primarily by a reaction where the hydroxyl group attacks the bromine, the phosphorus kicking out of bromine. So what I make first is the phosphorus with the oxygen bound here. There are two bromides still on this. And then a bromide comes in and knocks this out as a leaving group. And this whole thing acts as a leaving group in inherently what is an SN2 step. And so that's how the bromide replaces that hydroxyl group in going and be able to do that. So that's number one way. Now you said another way, a really interesting way, which is a peroxide way. So peroxide, if I take this reagent and treat it with HBr and peroxide, this indeed will put the bromide in that position. But the mechanism of that is what's interesting. The mechanism is a free radical mechanism. And we need to understand how that free radical mechanism works. And so that's the interesting part about this one. And it's not just peroxide. Normally what we do is we use light or heat with that peroxide. All right, and so I'm gonna be cognizant of my time here. I'm gonna show you just briefly, but I think when we start back on Wednesday, we'll pick it up. Today is Wednesday. When we start back on Monday, we'll pick it back up with this and we'll look at this in a little more detail. But that peroxide, the light striking that peroxide breaks it and it cleaves it symmetrically. It cleaves it in, we can have an asymmetric cleavage or a symmetric cleavage. In this case, it does it as a symmetric cleavage where it breaks it in a free radical mechanism and it produces two free radicals. Those two free radicals then work with HBr and they do a free radical abstraction of the proton, creating bromide radical. So this creates water. And the other thing that it creates is the bromine free radical. The bromine free radical then reacts with the hydrocarbon. And the hydrocarbon reacts with the bromine free radical to produce the more stable carbon free radical. And this is the part that we need to talk more about, is that the bromine adds first, making the more stable secondary carbon free radical. And so it's the idea here that the bromine adds first that changes this reactivity. And that's the whole idea behind this free radical mechanism. Now the carbon free radical will grab a proton from the HBr to finish this reaction mechanism off. So the last thing that happens in this reaction mechanism is that there's another HBr and this guy grabs that proton, kicking an electron back to the bromide. And it's a propagation step. The reaction keeps going. It makes more bromine free radical. And that's your final product. And the bromine free radical continues going on with this reaction mechanism. The reaction mechanism goes in a cycle and keeps on going. So the free radical mechanism does indeed allow us to change this reaction mechanism and to put the bromide in the terminal position. So we have two options. We can do it with hydroboration and then a subsequent reaction using PBr3, or we could do it with HBr and peroxide, which is a really beautiful mechanism in that it's still a Markovnikov addition. It's just that you have changed, instead of the hydrogen adding first, the bromide adds first. And because the bromide adds first, it goes through the more stable free radical. And free radical stability follows carbocation stability. So when we come back on Wednesday, we'll pick it up. It's Monday. We'll pick it up on Monday. And we will compare free radical stability with carbocation stability. And we'll look at the differences and the similarities between free radicals and carbocations. And we'll look at some of these reactions from that viewpoint. Okay, keep working on those alkene problems. I think I'm going to put an alkene quiz based on some of the things that we've done. I'll put an alkene quiz together, give you guys some time to do it. So look for that. I'll email out in the Canvas shell when it comes out too, so that you guys don't miss it. And I'll let you know what the due date is, okay? Everybody good? Any questions? All right, there was a lot of stuff today. You guys hung in there with me. I appreciate it. All right, take care, guys.
Thank you, Jason.
Thank you.
Thanks.